Wellness is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In cities all across the United States, big ones and small ones, police departments are working to form partnerships with members of their communities. Now, this kind of cooperation can be difficult. It means that it has to be indeed a partnership. It has to involve a commitment by people on both sides of this line, and it also can be complicated by past relations between citizens and the police. But when it works, it can have a number of benefits. Certainly, it can make police more accountable for what happens in the neighborhoods where they patrol, and it can involve the community in identifying and solving problems. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the changing role of community policing. And our guest for the show is Wesley Scogan. He's professor of political science at Northwestern University. He's also a faculty fellow in the Institute for Policy Research there at Northwestern. He is an expert on crime and the police, and he has directed most of the major crime studies that have been done by the Institute for Policy Research over the past two decades, including studies that looked at fear of crime, at citizen participation in community crime prevention, and also in victim responses to crime. He is involved in a four-university evaluation of the city's experimental citywide community policing initiative, and in his research looks at citizens as producers and consumers of law. He's speaking to us this morning from Northwestern. We have one of those nice, high-quality connections set up between here and there, and we thank the folks at Northwestern on their end for making this possible. And as we move along here through the hour, of course, questions are welcome. We'd like to involve people in the conversation. You can do that by calling us. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. If you're listening somewhere around Illinois and Indiana, and it would be a long-distance call, actually, if you're listening also on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Scogan, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's just do a little defining of our terms just to start out so people know what it is we're talking about. Give us the basic definition of community policing.
Sure. Let me give you the short definition as opposed to the 45-minute lecture.
Okay.
In short, and we'll get back to the details as we go along, in short, it's three things. First of all, on the police side, it involves changing the organization. Police have to figure out how to decentralize themselves and attach police officers to small pieces of turf, neighborhoods, so that they can become acquainted with the residents there and the nature of the problems. So changing the organization is the first thing, and that's, you mentioned it was community policing is difficult, and this is one of the very difficult parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
The second of the three parts is finding ways to engage with the public as the police go about their business. In some places, this is accomplished by community meetings between street officers and neighborhood residents. In other places, it's done with advisory councils that are set up to represent police districts or neighborhoods. In lots of cities, police do surveys, either formal surveys or informal surveys, to try to assess what the heck is on the minds of the public, and then find ways to help make the public's priorities their priorities, which can sometimes be a new process. So that's also, as you might imagine, also difficult, as you referred to in your opener. The past relations between police and the public sometimes haven't been so terrific, and so it's hard to make that work. And then there's the third part, which is police partnering with public and private agencies to help them more effectively address a very broad range of community problems. Police have to become problem solvers, which is different in significant ways from driving fast in response to 911 calls, which is what they used to do. When police move toward a community-oriented stance, what they discover is the public is also very worried about a whole variety of social disorders and physical decay issues. The public places a high priority on things like graffiti that the police did not place a very high priority on. And the police can't get graffiti cleaned up. They got to partner with city agencies that can work on the graffiti problem. So doing that problem solving and involving other city agencies, and believe me, that's a really hard problem politically, bureaucratically, and financially. So To make community policing work, you've got to change yourself, and you have to change other organizations, and you have to change the public. So it's no accident that this is a multi-year process, and it doesn't always succeed.
Yeah. This is something that it has been implemented, and there, as I said, there are communities the size of Chicago and the size of Champaign-Urbana and everything in between that have, over the past few years, tried to put some of these things in place. And how many, roughly speaking, in how many places are they trying to do some version of community policing?
The federal government does surveys where they try to track the progress of this because they have a big agency in Washington that's responsible for it. And here's the answer. The answer is everybody claims that they're doing it. It's very hard to find a city that doesn't want to say that they're doing community policing. It's popular with city councils. It's popular with the public. It's popular with the media. So as a result, it's popular with police chiefs. And so cities all over the country, almost every city of any size whatsoever, claims that it's doing community policing. Now, what it is that they do when they do community policing, of course, is the really interesting question. And that's highly variable, as it should be, by the way. The answer is because of the public clamor and the political support for it, and the fact that Washington has been putting billions of dollars into it, has made this a pretty common program around the country.
You talked about the fact that there were these basic features of community policing, and the first thing that you mentioned was that you have to change the way perhaps departments are organized and attach officers to small geographic areas so that they get to know that neighborhood or that place. They get to know those people. The people get to know them. It strikes me that we're talking about going back to beats, which seemed to me that was what at one time police officers did when mostly police officers went around on foot, or maybe even at the time that they started to use automobiles, they were still assigned to patrol specific geographic areas, and that people, they knew that place and that people knew them. Is this going back to an older idea?
It is exactly doing that. It's doing it for a new reason, but the old organization was a pretty wise one. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of a town I know, Fort Worth, Texas, which has a population of 550,000. It's a very substantial place. All the police officers in town came and parked in two huge parking lots, one behind police headquarters downtown and one out on the edge of town near the freeway. And they got in their cars, and the computer immediately started dispatching them, and they drove all over town. By the end of the day, they might be 40 miles away, because Fort Worth is a really big place. And they just went from call to call and didn't even always know exactly where they were. And they didn't have any connection at all to the neighborhoods that they were serving. The parking lot was what they knew best. When they moved toward community policing in Fort Worth, first of all, they went to Los Angeles and got themselves a really good new police chief. And the first thing that he did was he broke the city down into 15 little districts. And he closed the big parking lot downtown. And he made that big parking lot out on the edge of town just simply one of the 15 districts. And he put his officers out into storefronts, out in the neighborhoods, into a couple of schools that were no longer being used, and turned it into a very neighborhood-oriented organization. And the people in Fort Worth are very proud, in fact, of their neighborhood police stations. They have celebrations every year. They march in parades around their police stations. And it's really made a dramatic change in the relationship between the police and the public. So that kind of radical downsizing is what, you know, smart chiefs figure that they have to do.
What happened that we moved away, that if you go back far enough, that you find the more of a tendency for officers to have beats and to get to know particular places? What happened to move away from that to this other style that you talked about, where, in a sense, all officers patrol the entire jurisdiction and that you could be going anywhere at any time?
Sure. Two things happened. One was technology, and the other one was a change in management philosophy. And the two worked together to make this change happen. The technology, of course, first of all, is the telephone. And that starts to be ubiquitous in American cities by, say, 1915. And then the second thing is the radios in the cars. And once the public can directly call downtown on the telephone, and downtown can directly contact the officers in the cars, the technological possibilities for centralization of the whole operation, you can see exactly how that might work. Mm-hmm. Then what happens is, starting at the late 1950s, a kind of a business-oriented professional management style starts to creep into policing for the first time. There starts to be, for the first time, computers and databases where police can start analyzing their effectiveness, and then they can start using the computers to do the control of dispatching. And so that an efficiency-oriented management style downtown, plus the cars with the radios and the public with the telephones, shifts us from beat officers who walk around or sit in stations and wait for the public to come to them, to a police that's constantly on the move, waiting to be dispatched for the next call. So it's both technology makes it happen, but also this management philosophy, starting in the 1950s, of what they called professional policing, which stressed centralized control, centralized management, an efficiency orientation, getting more bang for the buck. That's what caused that centralized style and made police basically abandon the beats and move toward a really headquarters-oriented organization. Yeah.
Well, I can imagine if you move toward this kind of move back, in a sense, move back to a sort of older way of thinking about how you allocate your resources, I can imagine some departments there saying, well, what happens if, I have particular officers that are assigned to particular geographic regions, and suppose something big happens, and I get all those officers tied up in responding to some serious call, and something else happens. So what do I do? Do I take guys from the neighboring district and I send them over there? Do I have some people who are floating purposely so that they can go anywhere? I guess I would say maybe my response, if I was a chief, would be to say, well, the kind of system that you're suggesting that I move away from gives me a lot more flexibility in terms of how it is I respond to calls.
Absolutely. Cities vary. Here in Chicago, the goal is that patrol officers stay on their beat 70% of the time. Hmm. They figured 30% is the kind of real-world kind of sloppiness that they have in the organization, and the fact that, as you pointed out, calls pile up and they have to be dealt with. But 70% is their goal, and they come pretty close to 70% most of the time. And then, of course, you also have lots of specialized squads who are still in business, who are still out there. Gang officers, intelligence officers, narcotics teams, undercover investigators of all kinds. And you still have them to throw at particular problems. And then when a crisis comes, when the tunnels flood or the building catches on fire, certainly you still have all that technology and the capacity to move people around. So staying on your beat is a goal, not some kind of rigid rule. And 70% in Chicago, anyway, has proven to be a pretty realistic figure. What's important is that they're there long enough that they get to know the people and the problems, and that the people get to know them through some of the other things that you can do to make the organization more community-friendly. Hmm. And 100% isn't really what's required.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Wesley Scogan. He's professor of political science at Northwestern University, also faculty fellow at the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern, and he is an expert on crime and the police. We're talking about community policing, and questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that contrary to what a lot of people would think, if all their experience with police is what they see on television, either news coverage or drama, they might be surprised that I think that a lot of policing is really routine, and you might actually even say it's boring. They spend a lot of time patrolling and driving around, or maybe on walk, or maybe on bicycles or whatever, just kind of keeping an eye on things and not really doing much of anything. Now, I would say that should mean that actually police officers would have an opportunity to build some kind of relationship with the people in their neighborhoods, because there's a lot of times they are just kind of hanging out, going around and keeping an eye on things. But that also seems to me, in a way, kind of an unnatural situation, if people are just approached by an officer who just wants to chat or say, how are you doing, or what's going on, or do you have any concerns, I would think that people might think that there was something a little bit odd about that. How do you go about building that kind of casual, everyday relationship between the community and the police, particularly if there has been friction and tension before between the community and the police?
Absolutely. You need to have an icebreaker. I mean, any social relationship needs to have an icebreaker. Think about going to a cocktail party where you don't know anybody there. You sort of stand in the corner and look nervous. And it's the same way out in the real world. Finding ways to do this icebreaker is part of the second part of community policing, which is finding ways to engage the public. And as I said before, cities do this in a variety of ways. The Chicago model is the small public meeting. Chicago has 280 little police beats, and every beat has a public meeting every month. An average of about 35 people come in the summer when the weather's good. We have serious weather in Chicago, as you know, so the attendance is down a little bit in January and February. And there they meet the officers who are actually working the streets in those neighborhoods, the guys who are on patrol right then, and then some from other shifts who are paid overtime to come to the meetings. So they have a chance to meet the police and to meet each other. What these little groups do often is they form phone trees. People sign up with their name and telephone number. They, in various ways, they get involved in community cleanup programs, in problem-solving programs. So one of the icebreakers is the public meeting. The others are the kind of marches and rallies that are very commonly held in a city like Chicago. August 1st this year and every year is National Night Out, and that's a big event in police districts around the country, where that's an opportunity to stir people to come out and meet their neighbors and meet police officers. But also, there are ways in which the police do this on their own, proactively, sort of to break the ice. I can think of lots of examples of departments who send officers out, especially in the afternoon. As you pointed out, sometimes it's not always that busy, especially in the afternoon. And they'll go out and they'll do door knocking campaigns, where they'll go around, they'll leave literature about, say, the next public meeting. They'll leave some crime prevention announcements. And they'll ask people what their concerns are. And they'll do that by coming to the door. And that may seem surprising, but they do this with lots of advanced warm-up through the media.
Yeah, I would think there would have to be, or else people, if suddenly a police officer is knocking on their door, I'm sure that would make them nervous and wonder, well, what's this all about? Why is this person knocking on my door?
Absolutely. And that's why the officers have to be well prepared and have a really, really clear agenda when they do this. In some towns, they do this, they go back and revisit recent crime victims, people who were burglarized, say, a week before, to, you know, find out if anything has happened, if they need another copy of their the offense report for insurance purposes. Have they heard any rumors about who might have done it? Have they found any of their property? And these kinds of revisits of victims, these turn out to be surprisingly popular and surprisingly effective. It turns out that sort of revisiting victims who have actually gained quite a bit of information about what's happened since the last time they talked to the police has some payoff even in terms of crime prevention. But mostly they rely on public meetings and marches and rallies and advisory councils that get set up at the district level in order to make these kind of public contacts. Mm.
You talked about the fact that one of the things that maybe surprises people on the, you know, the police administrative, the government side, is that maybe when they get the opportunity to talk with community members about what's important to them, what their priorities there are, they're surprising what they are, and that they're maybe not, either they're not the same priorities of the police, or they're not what immediately the police would think were priorities. So, for example, your point was graffiti, that maybe in people in communities, that's something they're really concerned about, and that then what the police can do is then they can say, well, we hear your concerns, and we'll pass them on to the people that deal with that kind of thing. I'm interested in perhaps you talking a little bit more about that kind of a sort of disconnect in terms of what's really important and what the kinds of things that community people say, these are our priorities, that may be sort of surprising, or maybe the thing is that they just don't fit clearly into the mandate of the police, maybe some other part of government, but not the mandate of police.
Well, one of the things that happens with community policing is the mandate of the police tends to grow a bit, and especially as they start to coordinate with other agencies to get things done. Let me give you some examples of problems that come up in a really big way during public meetings and in our surveys. One, for example, is public drinking. In Chicago, among Latinos, public drinking is the number one rated problem. In other neighborhoods, it will be street prostitution, which is taken more seriously by the police, but public drinking, by and large, is not. We've mentioned graffiti, abandoned cars. When Chicago's community policing program began, it was estimated that there were 10,000 abandoned cars on the streets of Chicago. And in meeting after meeting, what the police heard was that These cars need to be towed. It's been there for months. We keep calling, nothing ever happens. So abandoned cars gets on the agenda in a big way. Abandoned buildings turn out to be a big problem for neighbors. Kids hide out in them. People come and strip them of their fixtures, strip the copper wiring out of the walls. Homeless people sleep in them. Runaways sleep in them. Somebody sets it on fire. People get very nervous when a building falls abandoned, and they want the police to do something about making sure that the landlord gets it boarded up. Buildings where the landlord has let the building get out of control, where people have gotten out of the habit of taking their garbage to the garbage cans, instead they mail it out the back window into the alley, and it piles up in the alley and the bags break. And that leads to another problem, which is commonly brought up in beat meetings, rats in the alley. Hmm. Now, rats in the alley is a classic beat meeting problem. And, you know, it's, again, something that police themselves can't do anything about. But there are other agencies that take that very seriously. So sparking them to get involved is one of the things that police can do. Other kinds of physical decay issues as well. Building dilapidation, trash and junk on the streets and sidewalks, abandoned refrigerators and mattresses and vacant lots. The refrigerators are dangerous. The mattresses are an eyesore. These are the kinds of things that really drive neighbors crazy. It causes them to want to move, makes them unhappy with the neighborhood that they're living in. Before, they fell between the cracks, by and large. When police meet with the public, what they find is that these are the things that neighbors really want something done about. That's why linking with other agencies to get into a more broad-based problem solving is a real big concern.
Yeah.
The public is also concerned about disorderly things, especially disorderly kids. Groups of kids hanging out, maybe intimidating people as they walk on the streets, rumors that kids have taken over the parks at night. These are more difficult for the police to deal with because there's serious civil liberties issues and limits on police power. But the public is very concerned about loitering. The public is very concerned about rumors of street drug sales. These cause really tremendous anxiety where they become serious issues in neighborhoods. And the complaints about these things at public meetings are also very, very frequent.
Yeah. You can see that some of these are really police problems because they do have to do with law breaking and law enforcement, things like public drinking, prostitution, sales of drugs, disorderly conduct, that sort of thing. But that some of these other things, as you say, really do fall into the area of responsibility of other agencies of government. And I wonder, in these places where they're trying to take this kind of strategy, and that then the police are getting in all this information from people who have all these concerns about their community, and then the police have to go to other areas of government, other agencies of government, say, look, this is your issue. This is something that you have to do something about. These people here are telling us that they're really concerned about these abandoned cars and abandoned buildings and trash that's not being collected or trash that's being dumped or problems with rats, all that sort of stuff. It's somebody else's issue, as far as the police are concerned. Does that sometimes create difficulty among various units of government? Because now the police are saying to whoever it is, the people who deal with these other things, look, you're not doing your job. Here are problems here, and our people are telling us that there are these problems, and you got to get on this.
Absolutely. Community policing exposes governance problems in cities. Cities, like other units of government, tend to be pretty well managed and professionally run within their little organizational silos. So the people who clean up the streets, and the people who trim the trees, but they have a set of bureaucratic routines. They have a plan. This year we're going to do this neighborhood, next year we're going to do that neighborhood. And all of a sudden the police show up and they say, you know, we've got some priorities, and these are not the bureaucratic priorities. There's nothing wrong with those bureaucratic priorities, but they're not accustomed to being responsive to the police. And so in a city that has an effective community policing program, the first message is that to be effective, a community policing program has to be the city's program, not the police department's program. If it's the police department's program, it's not going to succeed. To be the city's problem, it's a governance problem. And this is, as I said before, really one of the hard issues. I was once talking with a fellow who was the police chief at the time of a big eastern city. I'll tell you that it was Boston. And he was moving his department toward a very substantial community policing program. And he told me that he wasn't worried about the police department part of it. He could handle his department. But he was worried that he couldn't handle his mayor, that Mayor Mineo didn't have the commitment that it would take to push the other city agencies into getting in the coordination mode with the police. So his concern was not his department. His concern was his mayor. And I think that that's a substantial concern of lots of police chiefs who understand what they're going to be called upon to do and don't want to be able to say we can't do anything about that problem. Now, that's the kiss of death when it comes to trying to be responsive to the public, to say it's somebody else's problem. Don't bother us about that. So it's a real governance problem for cities to find ways to coordinate these services. In the first years of Chicago's community policing program, that turned out to be one of the most effective parts of the program. But that was partly because Mayor Daley understood this from the beginning. And very early on, he called the heads of his city agencies into a big meeting, described how the program was going to work, and told them they were either going to get with the program or leave. They got the message. And in a variety of ways, he got the other agencies to move. They set up a computer system for logging citizen complaints, for keeping track of how long it took to get the problem solved, for kicking out special reports on problems that didn't seem to be getting solved. And until the city's 311 system came along a decade later, this was the primary device that the mayor used to coordinate and make city services more effective. But you're exactly right. To be an effective problem solver is a governance problem. It's not just a police problem.
Mm. We're a little bit past our midpoint here of this first hour of Focus. We're talking with Wesley Scogin. He's professor of political science at Northwestern University. He's also a faculty fellow in the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern. He's an expert on crime and the police. He's directed most of the major crime studies that the Institute has done over the last two decades, and has done research on fear of crime, on citizen participation in community crime prevention, and also victim responses to crime, and has been involved in an evaluation involving four different universities of Chicago's citywide community policing initiative. Questions welcome. We have somebody here who is ready to talk with us. Other people who are listening certainly are welcome to call. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hello. My own contacts with police owning a home here in Champaign-Urbana have been pretty negative, but I won't get into that. I've got a comment and a couple questions. My comment is, when listening to you, it brings up comparisons to the way our soldiers are acting in the Middle East in our war on terrorism, because it's basically kind of a policing action, and there's been a lot of news stating that they've been trying to make that connection you were talking about with the Middle Easterners. I thought that was kind of interesting, but I've got a couple questions. One is, I understand that can you tell me what the real story is in San Diego? I understand that there was a study last year called Problem-Oriented Policing in Practice, and that it kind of did not reflect all that well on this kind of community-oriented policing, and thought that its goals were not met. And then number two, and I'll hang up, is I was wondering if there's been a lot of news lately about witness intimidation, and I was curious if there'd been any success using this method in alleviating that kind of problem where witnesses fail to come forward because, you know, they're intimidated intimidated by, say, gangs, for example. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you make some
Well, I'm disappointed thoughts? Our caller's hanging up, because these were two really excellent questions, and we could hope for some follow-up. Let me take the questions backwards, and first of all, talk about witness intimidation. Yeah, you betcha. This is a real substantial problem in high-crime neighborhoods, especially those where large, dangerous professional gangs are involved. People are rightfully afraid to be seen as being involved with the police, to be seen as turning out. We did a study of almost 300 BEAT meetings not long ago here in Chicago, and there was discussion, there was public discussion at the meeting about retaliation and intimidation that could occur because people were there almost 25% of the time. So it's very much on the minds of neighborhood residents. This fear was very much most often expressed in neighborhoods where there were serious gangs, both Latino neighborhoods and African-American neighborhoods. And the police have had to find ways to accommodate people's fears. One way is providing alternatives to speaking up in public, suggestion boxes in police stations, telephone numbers that they can call and speak directly with officers without having to have them come to their door, and other ways that you can put information into the pipeline without being seen speaking up in public. But there's no question that people are fearful about turning out, that people are fearful about being seen speaking up and dealing with the police. This problem was there before community policing, and it continues to be a real one. So that simply finding alternatives to being seen as publicly involved is one of the tricks that departments have to figure out. As for the first question, problem-oriented policing, I suggested that was the third leg of this three-legged stool that we call community policing, getting involved in identifying and fixing problems, you know, in conjunction with the public, so that the definition of what a problem was got a lot broader. And that's hard. It's hard for those other city agencies. I talked about this as a governance problem. But it's also really hard for the police. Your rank-and-file police officer can have great difficulty understanding what the heck this is about and what it's supposed to mean. They signed up to do one kind of job and find themselves being asked to do some different kind of job, and they're not always happy about that. And they're not always very well trained. Training is really expensive and difficult in police departments, and so they tend to shortchange it. Our caller was very well informed at the expense of boring some other listeners with an academic lecture. Let me just say that indeed there was a very nice study of problem-oriented policing in San Diego by Gary Cordner, and what he found was that what was going on in San Diego was very simplistic, not very sophisticated. That to the rank-and-file police officer, a problem was some bad guy, and the solution was to figure out how to arrest the bad guy. And it didn't go much further than that. I could say some things about the San Diego program. One is that it's not linked to other city agencies. A couple of years ago, I got several calls from sergeants in San Diego who were trying to figure out how to get other city agencies involved in problem solving. They'd heard that was important and was really working in Chicago, but in San Diego, it wasn't working at all. In San Diego, problem solving was the police department's program, and they didn't have these links to the other city agencies. So as a result, the police are on their own when it comes to identifying and solving these problems. So not surprisingly, they don't get around to rats in the alley because they don't have any way of fixing the rats in the alley problem. So San Diego had a very professionalized police problem-solving program, but they did not have a city problem-solving program. And as a result, it wasn't very effective. Other cities which have worked hard to integrate problem-solving with other agencies have had a lot more success. I'll give you an example there would be Minneapolis, would be a very successful program in that regard. A city that I mentioned before, Fort Worth, is more like San Diego. I was talking with a neighborhood officer in Fort Worth and asked him about how he could get a car towed if people were complaining about an abandoned car. And his answer was to give me a big sigh and say that he was lucky because his brother-in-law worked for the part of the city that towed cars. So he would call his brother-in-law, but he allowed us how other parts of Fort Worth, who didn't happen to have brother-in-laws in the car towing business, had a great deal of difficulty because in Fort Worth, problem solving was the police department's program. So cities will vary in terms of how effectively they make this work. And I think being the city's program is the number one key.
All right. Of course, other questions here, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, Ken, based upon your research, can you say that that as a result of doing this, say, in the city of Chicago, that the relationship between police and community has improved? Has this had some effect on, for example, the number of complaints or charges of police misconduct or people who feel that they were roughly handled by police or improperly dealt with by the police?
One of the ways we've been trying to monitor this is by doing surveys of Chicagoans, and we've been doing these yearly or bi-yearly ever since 1993, and we find two things. First of all, there's been a substantial improvement in people's views of the police, improving by 10 to 15 percentage points, depending on the question. We look at reports of how well police treat people in the neighborhood. We look at the extent to which police are being seen as responsive to neighborhood concerns when it comes to solving problems. And we look at people's perception of the police effectiveness at the traditional tasks of policing, responding to crime. And very substantial improvements over time, over the 13 years that we did this monitoring. And these improvements were widespread. It was true for African Americans, it was true for Latinos, it was true for whites, it was true for all of the big demographic groups in Chicago. The bad news is that after 13 years of community policing, the community is still deeply divided. The situation was so bad in the early 90s that even after 13 years of improvement, we're now talking about Latinos and African Americans, about 50% think that they're getting good service, and about 50% think that they're getting bad service. So the sad news in Chicago is that we've now gotten to the point where the glass is half full, whereas previously it was worse than that. Whites were much more satisfied before the program began, and they're much more satisfied now. Chicago's made progress, but boy, there's still a long way to go.
How about if you take a look at crime rates? Can you see any sort of relationship between implementation of community policing and crime rate in the sense that it helps crime prevention or greater sort of law enforcement that would have an effect on crime?
Sure. Chicago is like a lot of big cities. They've had a very, very substantial decline in crime over the last 15 years. It peaked in 1991, and it's been going down steadily ever since. For example, robbery is off by about 67%, which is a huge decline. And people are vastly safer. And in our surveys, by the way, they also report that they're vastly safer. Our measures of fear of crime have really improved dramatically over time. The question is, how much of that is due to increasing police effectiveness, and how much is due to all the other things that have gone into declining crime? And here's what we find. We find, first of all, evidence that crime went down more in the neighborhoods that got mobilized around community policing. It was a combination of community policing plus citizen mobilization. So the places where people were turning out for marches and rallies, places where people were turning out for the beat meetings, these are the places where crime went down a little extra, a little more of a decline in those kinds of places. And the second one was that in places that they were, the police had implemented their program more effectively across a broad bunch of measures, crime was also down a little more there as well. But I want to stress it's a little more. The big trends that were going on in Chicago, as in other cities, continue to go on. But policing did make a noticeable incremental change, a contribution to that decline over time. Hmm.
We have about 15 minutes left. We have several callers. We'll try to get as many as we can. I also should introduce again our guest, Wesley Scogin. He's professor of political science at Northwestern University, a faculty fellow at the Institute for Policy Research there, and is an expert on crime and the police. We're talking about community policing. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. But if you call right now, you will get a busy signal because the lines are full. So we'll get back to some callers here. We'll start with first in line, and that's someone in Aurora on our line four. Hello.
I'm very interested in what you were speaking about, and I wanted to tell you about an incident in Aurora. There is a very, very fine family, a mother and father, very fine in every aspect, and they are leaving Aurora because of the crime. And I think that is what will happen. I'm moving out of my neighborhood, not only because of that, but that has influenced me. And I think that's what is the shame, that we feel the way we do, and we have to do something about it, and we cause a vacuum. And everybody knows nature doesn't like vacuums, and something's going to fill it up.
Well, Professor Scogin, you have some comment?
Absolutely. There's no question that during the 1970s and the 1980s that center city crime was one of the major factors that propelled people to move out and move to the suburbs. The family-oriented people went first. People who were more fearful about crime went first. But it was a major force, maybe the number one force, propelling people to move to the suburbs. The 70s and the 80s were the time when crime was really skyrocketing in this country. If you take a look at a graph of crime over time, wow, was it going up. And it was going up most in big cities. Crime is really concentrated in the hearts of big American cities. And one of the lasting legacies of the crime of the 70s and 80s was the suburbanization of American life. So it's had very bad consequences for center cities. On the other hand, the decline in crime in the 90s across the country has had some very positive consequences. A very nice study by the Federal Reserve Bank, for example, found that about one-third of the increase in property values in New York City during the course of the 90s and 2000s, about a third of the property value increase was because of declining crime. Crime is down a lot in New York, and that has really helped bring the city back in a substantial way. So it was bad in the 80s and in the 70s and 80s. It's been much better for cities in general in the 90s. And in a particular town like Aurora, of course, patterns can be different. Things can go up and down. Demography of cities can change differently in different kinds of places. But that the phenomenon that your callers identified, people getting out of town because of concern about crime, and not always just concern about the fear about themselves being victims, but their families, their spouses, and especially their children, getting them out of that environment is a big motivator to get people to leave. So it's been one of the big legacies of crime in America has been the suburbanization of American life.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. It's interesting, though, you know, on Friday on the program, we're going to be talking about gang violence in Chicago, as a matter of fact. And one of the things that apparently has happened in not only in Chicago and other places, though, is that the gangs have now started to branch out into the suburbs.
Well, that's exactly right. Gangs are, I mean, there was a time, I'm an old enough guy to remember when we used to call them youth gangs, by the way, when they were called youth gangs, and they were... It was sort of West Side Story, and people fought over girls and turf and ethnic pride, and then they grew up. Gangs have stopped being youth gangs in big cities. They've become much more professionalized, and they make big, serious money in the drugs business and other related criminal enterprises. And they search out new markets, and they're as entrepreneurial as anybody that you can imagine, They go where the money is, and they go where the people are, and that is the suburbs. And so colonizing suburbs, colonizing other parts of the state is something that serious gangs certainly get involved in. And so cities need to be vigilant in watching out for this because it's a very real phenomenon.
Let's talk with someone in Charleston next. Line number one. Hello.
Yes. I have a comment and then a little example. Nationwide, worldwide, the very things you've been talking about today addresses mainly social problems and the fallout of the system under which we live, money being the rule, when you have access and when you don't. Well, that's my take on the subject matter of today. A little personal experience I have had here in Charleston. I moved to the north end of town, which is rather poor, and built a house, and I live there to this day. When I moved there, everybody had a trash barrel, and they burned it, and day and night. And I finally went to the fire chief and asked him what I could do, and he told me the law. And the only thing I could do, since the police would not respond to what they saw, I had to call the police or the fire department and have those things rectified. As a result, I was very hated and still not very well liked in the neighborhood to this day, but nobody burns, nobody has the courage or the desire to attack me now, and the whole thing is cleaner. But I had to bear the brunt of it. I went to city council meetings for years and tried to address the problem. The mayor, all he wanted to do was fight crime in the persona of the college student, who it was a little college town, 10,000-11,000 students. They bring their habits with them, and he began to attack them mercilessly with the bald-headed police and any other method that was possible. Meanwhile, neglected homegrown problems that could have been addressed. And I do agree with your guest in as much that the police should live in the neighborhood. Everybody should know them. They should have the power to address the small problems such as mine, like the trash burning or other debris scattered around. And that, when the cop lives in the neighborhood, then he becomes the agent of the state and or the social organization in a small town. So, but anyway, those are my thoughts on the matter and what I lived through and the results of that, which now has been rectified to some degree. But it was one of those things that it was left to me, and it was neighbor on neighbor, which relates to the old Irish paradigm, you know, the snitch is the first to die. And so I'll end there, and I'll listen to your answer on the radio. Right. Thank you.
Well, again, I guess, Professor Gogan, that does go back to the issue we talked a little bit about earlier, but sometimes it can be very difficult for community members to stand up and identify themselves and say, I think this is a problem, and I think that something should be done about it.
Absolutely. Being a vigilant citizen is not always an easy role, especially when you're standing out there alone. However, being a vigilant citizen in the context of a program that's encouraging vigilance and sustaining vigilance and getting people together with other vigilant citizens and acting in a group is a much more vigilant-friendly way of doing it. It's a difference between isolated individuals working alone and people who are working through structured programs, and that's what community policing is about. It's about turning vigilance into a structured, supported community activity, one that people understand, that there's been a media campaign explaining what they're up to and the importance of it, one where, as in Chicago, twice a year there are big events, recognition events for activists. They come, they meet the mayor, they get a free drink, and people get the message that there's other folks like them involved in neighborhoods across the city, and that this is a very valued thing. So moving from isolated vigilance to group vigilance, without getting into the vigilante problem, which is a whole other track, it seems to me, is what it is that cities should be about.
Let's see if we can get at least one more caller. The next in line is Champaign in line two. Hello.
Yeah. Is there such a thing as sort of a top 10 of the cities across the country that really do an outstanding job? In other words, they do, you're talking about the three parts, is there such a thing, or?
Where do you think they're doing the best?
Well, as I pointed out, San Diego has a terrific police-centered program, but not a city program. One of the things about community policing is it varies. It's very different from place to place, as it should be, because different cities have different issues. And so it's hard to talk about a top 10 across the board, but rather different places are excellent at doing different things. Problem solving, for example, that really hard part, because you have to involve police officers in a new and creative way. A city that does very well at problem solving is Charlotte-Mecklenburg. Charlotte-Mecklenburg Charlotte's a wonderful town, and they have a city-county integration of the police, and they do a terrific job of linking city services to police and of training, really spending the time that it takes to train police officers to understand what problem solving is about. And they've done this for a long time, and they've become very effective at that. An example of a city which has been trying hard to use its community policing program to build a sense of community among residents would be Reno, Nevada. Reno is also a city-county integrated police department, and Reno's a rapidly growing place like cities are out there. They've identified the lack of community, of community identification, of people knowing their neighbors as being the big problem in Reno. And so they've really been stressing the citizen involvement, meet your neighbors, get involved in your neighborhood parts of the program, because that's what they thought was their big problem. So cities tend to excel when they think, when they've identified what is a real problem for them and have focused on it in a serious way. In the case of Minneapolis, it's a huge Southeast Asian refugee population among other groups, and about 50,000 Somalis who have moved to Minneapolis, St. Paul as part of a federal resettlement program of immigrants, trying to move them from the coasts into the heart of the country. And so they've got a real kind of ethnic communication problem, surprising as it might be for Minneapolis. And they've really had to work hard at integrating and absorbing and finding ways to communicate with a really different immigrant population. That they see that as their biggest problem in Minneapolis and work hard to address that. Cities' problems differ from place to place, they do different things to address them. There's been some successes. There's also been, of course, some real failures. Cities try hard and simply don't succeed. There's resistance from other parts of city government who aren't willing to bend their priorities to respond to the police. There's resistance from police unions who make it difficult to field an effective program. Seattle would be an example of a city like that.
Pardon me for jumping in there, Professor, but we're simply going to have to stop because we've used our time.
Oh, it was a great question.
And it was a good question, and I appreciate the questions of the callers. And I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time today, too.
Thank you, David.
Our guest, Wesley Scogin. He's professor of political science at Northwestern University. Also, our thanks to the folks at Northwestern on the other end of our ISDN connection.